From PRI, Public Radio International, it's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. On today's show, we look at The Weeknd. We'll meet one of Saturday Night Live's original writers, Anne Beats. And we'll take a look at Jean-Luc Godard's 1967 film Weekend. Also, the history of Sunday. But before Sunday comes Saturday Night. Another Saturday night.
I think my personal favorite was the Bay City Rollers, which was just S-A-T-U-R-D-A-Y, which I think I feel particularly nostalgic about because it was a big song when I was a kid, and little did I know that someday I would be sitting and doing research in the ASCAP library trying to find all the songs ever written with Saturday Night in the name, and believe me, it is a long list, except for Moon and June, if I remember correctly, and of course, if you don't count Love, because that's not fair, since obviously that's in the name of almost every song ever written. But Saturday Night is probably one of the most common phrases. Again, to me, that meant that it means something to us. Just a very rich phrase that is a shorthand for a lot that is the subject of song, of love and romance and longing.
Hey now, Saturday night is the loneliest night of the week, and I sing the song that I sang for the memories I usually seek, until I hear you rap on the door. Till you're in my arms once more. Saturday night is the loneliest night of the week.
Journalist Susan Orlean talking about one of the most popular subjects for songs, Saturday night. Orlean spent several Saturday nights with different people across the United States in an effort to find out what makes this night so special. She wrote about her experiences in a book called Saturday Night. Orlean told Steve Paulson about one of her earliest Saturday night excursions in Elkhart, Indiana.
This was a great occasion where I went to see Cruising in a small city, which Elkhart is. And you could drive your car up and down the street any night of the week. I mean, there's nothing about driving up and down on a Saturday night that's different, except in our mind, it's a special night. You want a night that feels different. And it is, in fact, for most people, the only night that doesn't follow a day of work and doesn't precede a day of work. So you have all day to get ready and all day to recover. So it is special. And it was a night where people in Elkhart put on special clothes, washed the cars, and cruised around on Main Street. And you can't imagine anything that, if you look at it closely, seems more pointless, except it felt special. You would be out on Main Street, you'd see people you know, you'd wave to them. You could see them any other night of the week, but this felt unique. It lifted you out of the quotidian life, the ordinary daily existence that everyone had, and it felt special. And that's when it occurred to me that this was a very important part of our psyche, to be able to look forward to something different, to break up the monotony of what we do normally, whether even if it's a happy monotony, this need to have a peak that you look forward to, and then you start your week again heading towards that same peak. And in between, you wash your car.
But there's another side to Saturday nights, which you write about in that experience in Elkhart. You talk about going to a restaurant, and the waitress looked at you as you were kind of weird because you were there alone on Saturday night.
Well, and of course, this is another great irony in my life, which it seems to be my lot in life. I set off to do a book about Saturday night, which meant that I almost always was alone on Saturday night. I was always the odd one out, whether I was at a debutante party in Phoenix or cruising in Elkhart or at a church social in Houston. I was always the one who was away from home. And what we most enjoy on Saturday night is being with either with your loved one or at least to be around the people you know. It's the night you don't want to be a stranger. And I was a stranger for the years I was working on that book. As I remember, I was having dinner in Elkhart before going out cruising. I was alone in a restaurant, and really the waitress looked at me with such pity. I mean, it was almost as if she wanted to say, I'll put you in a quiet corner so no one will notice you. And I, in the meantime, was thinking, well, I'm here working. I'm, you know, getting ready to go out cruising. I was making little notes to myself. Once in a while, I would look around and think, my God, what am I doing? I'm here all alone in a restaurant in Elkhart, Indiana. My God, what kind of life am I leading? It was sort of a, unfortunately, using an overused word, but it was a meta experience of Saturday night. As I was getting ready to write about everyone else having fun, I was the one who was alone and working, which is another thing most of us like to avoid doing on Saturday night, is working.
Well, and you write about how Saturday night is supposed to be the best night of the week. I mean, you talk about the fun imperative. If you don't have fun, there's something wrong with you.
Oh, absolutely. I mean, who among us hasn't thought, you know, Friday night, Tuesday night, Thursday night, where you have nothing to do, who cares? You read a magazine, you watch television, but Saturday night, you feel like you've got to have fun. I always have thought that the fact that they put the worst shows on television on Saturday night is meant to just remind you that if you're home watching TV, you are a total loser. And, you know, there is nothing more sad than just being stuck at home watching TV if you wish you were doing something else. I mean, one thing about Saturday night is that it very much reflects where you are in your life.
Right. If you've got small kids, then the equation changes dramatically.
Absolutely. Or if you're newly married and you're just happy to snuggle up at home and watch a video, you know, it really is different depending on your circumstance, usually having to do with what your love life is all about. Because, of course, Saturday night is the most romantic night. It's the one loaded with the most connotations. If someone asks you out for a Thursday night dinner, it means one thing. If they ask you out on a Saturday night, it means something different.
Hmm. Aren't there actually all kinds of statistics about what people do on Saturday nights? That, I mean, they actually do go out on dates more often and eat out and and also, there's a lot more violence on Saturday nights.
It was fascinating to me that, you know, I took what was a really just an observation and an instinct that I had that Saturday felt different, and found that there were a raft of statistics that supported it. And then, you know, things like people travel the least on Saturday night. There are the fewest flights. Nobody goes out of town on a Saturday night. Definitely more violence, thus the name Saturday Night Special for cheap handguns. And there's a reason for it. There's more drinking on Saturday night. There's more domestic violence on Saturday night. And somebody said to me, well, the problem is that for a couple that's not getting along, you know, during the week they're working. During the weekend they've had all day Saturday together and Friday night. And by Saturday night, you know, if they've been drinking, forget it. So you have a much higher murder rate, much higher assault rate, and more people go out on dates. It's the biggest night for restaurants. It's fascinating how even though our culture has slowly removed most time orientation, you can work from home, the internet, all of these things that have really dissolved those boundaries. Even something like stores being open now on weekends and Saturday nights, which was not the case in the past. We still have a kind of innate cycle, and it peaks on Saturday night in those ways. That has not really changed.
There's another place you write about, apparently the busiest restaurant in North America, the Hilltop Steakhouse in Massachusetts near Boston. What was that like?
This is an amazing place. It's still alive and well and throwing down slabs of beef in front of thousands of people. It is an enormous place, multiple dining rooms. It's just spread out on this little hill in Saugus, Massachusetts. And you get a number. You go and you just plan on waiting at least an hour or two to get seated. And Saturday night, of course, is their huge night. And just the preparation, it was like planning the Normandy invasion, preparing for Saturday night at the Hilltop. And when you're talking about thousands of baked potatoes, thousands of steaks, thousands of, you know, sides of beef, it just was a military operation. And, you know, in a way, there was a whole culture of the people who worked there. Saturday night was the best night to work there. You made the most money. And it was a very coveted slot, even though Saturday night is not a night you want to work. If you're a waitress, if you're in a service business like that, that is the night you want to work because that's when you really make a lot of money. And it was so much fun to see this thing in action. And you got tons of people there who were on dates. You had families, but not that much. Saturday night diners are kind of different. You would have groups of friends and groups of couples and people on dates, but not as many families going out. I have a feeling on a Monday night you might see more families there. And the place would just hum. It was an organism in its fullest kind of moment on Saturday night. And then afterward, what was really interesting to me, because I followed around a waitress all night, and then there's a sort of second life, which is all of the waitresses and waiters and busboys and dishwashers all would go out after Saturday night. After the civilian Saturday night was over, It began for all the people who worked. And they were very wound up when they were done with work. They didn't just go home. So they went to the one or two places that were still open.
So they had really late Saturday nights then.
It would be, you know, midnight, and they would go out to have a glass of wine at – there was a VFW hall nearby that was open, and there was a huge Chinese restaurant that was also open. So dozens of people from the Hilltop would then go and have their Saturday night. So it was so interesting to me to see this sort of two-tiered experience.
Did you have a favorite Saturday night during all of your research on this book about what people do on Saturday night?
I think the one that I would say was my favorite was in Houston. I went to a church social in Houston. It was a community of people who had almost all come to Houston from Louisiana. They were all black Creole Louisianans who had moved to Houston in the past 20, 30 years for jobs. And they were sort of dispersed into the culture of Houston. But they still got together on Saturday night to enjoy Zydeco, which was the music that they'd grown up hearing in Louisiana and didn't really exist in Texas.
Ladies and gentlemen, next time we go do, we're going to take you back to 1955. Let's have a call, Paper My Shoe.
And they organized themselves to bring a Zydeco group from Louisiana most Saturday nights. Bring someone, this happened to be Buzu Chavez, who was coming from the parish in Louisiana that they were from, to entertain them, and everybody would gather, and it was like a family reunion. What was so lovely to me was this wish to kind of recreate a life that they really didn't have anymore. They all lived in Houston now. They weren't living in Louisiana.
I got the paper in my shoe. I got the paper in my shoe. Oh, but your mama don't know. Papa don't die.
But Saturday night was the night that they wanted to kind of keep, to recreate that, to get together. It was a reunion. It was a sort of reaching back to their roots. Plus, it was just tremendously fun. And in fact, the younger generation, the kids of these people who didn't grow up in Louisiana, were equally excited about it. So it had actually gone beyond just being nostalgia. It was a culture, and it was a moment to bring together people who had been dispersed in this big city. They would come together and reconnect. And it was really great. I just loved it. I loved the feeling of it, the spirit of it, and the way that it captured, to me, what Saturday night was. It was a special night. It was a night when you create a different little world that you inhabit for those 5 or 6 or 8 hours. And it sustains you in a way. It's a very important thing for us to have that in a way that makes you feel that your life has peaks and valleys, and that's a peak.
Thank you. Thank you all very much. Woo!
Susan Orlean is the author of Saturday Night. She spoke with Steve Paulson.
Well, you gassed her and a wheel, with your arm around your sweet one, your Oldsmobile, barreling down the boulevard. You're looking for the heart of Saturday night. Eight on Friday, and your pockets are jingling, and you see the lights, and you get all tingling, cause you're cruising with a six, and you're looking for the heart of Saturday night.
Although Susan Orlean said the worst TV shows air on Saturday nights, there's at least one notable exception. Saturday Night Live, the groundbreaking late-night comedy variety series on NBC. SNL is one of the longest-running network entertainment programs in American TV history. The first show aired in 1975. 30-some years later, it's still a Saturday night ritual for millions of people. Canadian Lorne Michaels created the show, and his fellow Canadian Doug Gordon created this feature story about one of Saturday Night Live's original writers, Ann Beats.
Live from New York, it's Saturday night!
And with those seven words, the face of American comedy was about to get an extreme makeover. Ann Beats was one of the original writers on Saturday Night Live. She was also one of the few women writers. Beats has described working on SNL as a cross between summer camp and concentration camp. What does she remember most about that first season?
I remember that there was a moment where I was very excited because I had done this Speed commercial, because I was in charge of producing the commercial parodies, and I wrote a Speed commercial.
Meet Ellen Sherman, Cleveland housewife and mother.
Hi, I'm a nuclear physicist and commissioner of consumer affairs. In my spare time, I do needlepoint, read, sculpt, take riding lessons, and brush up on my knowledge of current events. Thursday's my day at the daycare center, and then there's my work with the deaf. But I still have time left over to do all my own baking and practice my backhand, even though I'm on call 24 hours a day as a legal aid.
How does Ellen Sherman do it all? She's smart. She takes Speed. Yes, Speed. The tiny blue diet pill you don't have to be overweight to need.
And then I collect these paper bags. And I have them right here, all folded and everything. In case anyone needs a paper bag, I have one. Because I fold them neatly, you know. I don't fold them just any old way.
Why not ask your family doctor for a prescription today? And when that runs out, you can ask your neighbor's doctor. And your mother's doctor. And your college roommate's doctor. And your best friend from high school doctor. And your babysitter's doctor.
This had been used as an audition piece for the women on the show. And I ended up insisting, kind of, that I was going to perform it. And I did. And that was the first thing ever shot in Studio 8H as part of Saturday Night Live. And the camera equipment was not in good shape, the sound and camera. And the damn paper bags kept rustling. And I did like 27 takes of it. And it was just before lunch, too. So there was that pressure, the added pressure of it's going to be lunch. So that was on the Lily Tomlin show, and, you know, it got a good response. And I was very vindicated because mm-hmm. people had been sort of going, I just don't see what's funny about it, and so on. From a male perspective, you know, they didn't have the appreciation of the history of speed taking amongst desperate housewives.
Yeah. Do you think men feel threatened by funny women?
Oh, you know the answer to that, Doug.
Yes. The answer is yes. I know. I do know the answer.
Do you feel threatened?
Yeah, I guess I feel threatened by people in general, being this sick puppy that I am, you know, but yeah. But yeah.
That's because you're Canadian.
Yeah, I'm just threatened by.
Yeah.
Just, yeah, exactly.
Canadians are threatened by everything.
And Beats would know. She attended McGill University in Montreal. That's where she discovered the dark humor of Jewish writers J.D. Salinger, Philip Roth, and Bruce J. Friedman. Their work struck such a chord with Beats that she converted to Judaism. After graduating from McGill, Beats took her dark sense of humor to the National Lampoon magazine. She wrote a parody of a Volkswagen ad. The ad stated, "If Ted Kennedy drove a Volkswagen, he'd be president today." It was accompanied by a photo of a VW Beetle floating in a lake, referring, of course, to Chappaquiddick. Volkswagen's response? A $30 million damage suit against the National Lampoon. Lampoon agreed to withdraw all unsold copies of the issue, to destroy the plate of the ad, and to run Volkswagen's statement on the incident in an issue of the Lampoon. Despite that, or because of that, Beats became the first female editor of the National Lampoon. That's where she met her boyfriend, Michael O'Donohue. Saturday Night Live creator Lorne Michaels hired both Beats and O'Donohue to join the writing staff. So Beats and O'Donohue brought their dark, comedic sensibilities to SNL.
I think that Michael's taste and judgment influenced the show tremendously. I always said he was like the Cardinal Richelieu of the show, if if Lorne was Louis XIV, you know.
So what were you then, if Lorne was Louis XIV?
Well, I don't know. I was Madame de Montespan, I guess. You know, we kind of thought that we were hot, you know, hot stuff.
Mm-hmm.
And
you were right, of course, yeah.
Well, I mean, who knows?
Well,
but I mean, we were legends in our own mind.
History has proven that you were hot stuff. I think that's clear.
We were legends in our own minds, you know. So we had a kind of attitude, and that was useful and also not useful because, you know, I had a lot to learn. And, I mean, I was able to do dark things. One of the darker things that I know people really liked, which we know is a co-effort with Dan Aykroyd, was unsafe Halloween costumes, which was an Irwin Mainway sketch. And that was Danny and my putting our heads together.
All right, Mr. Mainway, if you don't think that was unsafe, how about this Halloween costume? Would you mark it under the label Invisible Pedestrian? It's an all-black suit, gloves, and mask. Now, it seems to me, Mr. Mainway, a child wearing this costume at night to go trick-or-treating is in grave danger of being hit by a car.
Car? What do you mean, car, Miss Face? I mean, you know, a car is a pretty big object, right? I mean, kids are smart today, you know. They know when a car's coming at them to jump out of the way. I mean, you know, most of the kids I know go trick-or-treating at houses, right? You don't see too many kids walking along the expressway knocking on windshields saying trick-or-treat, right? This is a sidewalk costume.
A sidewalk costume?
Yeah, I mean, you know, we don't recommend it for blind kids. I mean, see, there's a warning right on the label. Invisible pedestrian, not for blind kids. All right?
Does Ann Beats have any particular favorites among the many sketches that she wrote?
I can just tell you the ones that people seem to really remember, and I think all of them were probably co-written with Rosie Schuster, and particularly people remember the Todd and Lisa pieces with Billy and Gilda.
Quit it, pizza face! You're messing up my hair! Boy, are you ever immature!
Say, are there any new developments? What? I guess not. So, you know, you really ought to put some Band-Aids on those mosquito bites you got.
And then another one that people have a great fondness for, which Jim Downey also contributed to, was Fred Garvin, Male Prostitute, that Dan Aykroyd was in.
Hey,
horses, young lady. Hey. No ifs, ands, and buts about it.
Mr. Garvin.
You're spending the night with Fred Garvin, Male Prostitute.
Well, now, I have a work order here which specifies that I am to Roger you roundly till 6:15 tomorrow morning.
Even back then, the writers stayed up all night on Tuesday to write sketches that might or might not make it into that week's show. During one contract negotiation, Beats demanded and received a hospital bed for her office. Beats says that the time pressure made for some very intense work. It also led her to come up with her sketch comedy theory.
You know, I always say about sketches, it's not engraving humor. You know, they say if you were meant to spend a lot of time on it, it would be called engraving comedy, not sketch comedy. It's sketch comedy. It means you have to do it quickly, like a watercolor.
Ann Beats left Saturday Night Live after 5 years. She won an Emmy Award for her contributions to the show.
I do think that obviously the consciousness of Saturday Night Live changed comedy quite a bit. There's a disturbing legacy to me in some ways in that women are still struggling to be on an equal footing with men. So I see that conflict and struggle still continuing despite the success of many female comedians. For instance, in the area of late night, it's still pretty much of a man's world. There's no female host that's been successful. I mean, I worked on one late night show with a woman host, and it was just very difficult. People felt if she was funny, they felt she was bitchy. That's what the research came back as. The minute you make a joke, they cross their legs. I also am disturbed by the fact that I think comedy has become an industry. And I think I liked it better when it was done by amateurs in the sense of people who loved it. And now it's sort of a career choice. And people think about becoming a sitcom writer because they know that they could make a lot of money.
The pioneering comedy writer Ann Beats, one of the original writers on NBC's long-running comedy variety series Saturday Night Live. Beats went on to create the critically acclaimed 1982 CBS television series Square Pegs. She won a Writers Guild Award in 2001. These days, Beats teaches classes in sketch comedy writing at the University of Southern California and works on various creative projects. If you are interested in studying comedy writing and performing with her, you can find a link to her website on our website at ttbook.org. Coming up, the history of the first day, Sunday. And we'll explore the strange world of Jean-Luc Godard's film Weekend as we continue our Hour on the Weekend. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. Craig Harline is a history professor at Brigham Young University. He's also the author of Sunday, A History of the First Day, From Babylonia to the Super Bowl. Harline told Ann Strandchamps how Sunday evolved over the past several centuries.
Well, it takes me 380 pages to explain that, but I'll try to give you the short answer. Basically, after about 400, Sunday became a full day free from work. And therefore, there began to be discussion over what should be done the rest of the day, thus outside of worship. That's when Sunday began to take on this more Sabbath-like character. Christians debated, what is the nature of Sunday? Should it be like the Jewish Sabbath? Should it have different rules from the Jewish Sabbath, but the same spirit, essentially? And that's when it really began. And during the Middle Ages, that tendency toward the creation of what Christians called a sort of Christian Sabbath continued. The Puritans in the 16th and 17th century in England and in the Americas solidified that tradition, and they called Sunday the Sabbath. They didn't say it was merely a sort of Sabbath or a figurative Sabbath. It was the Sabbath, true and proper. It had been reinstituted by God on the new day of the week and so on. And so, therefore, the religious elements of Sunday have been there a long time.
So you've done a kind of interesting thing in this book. Rather than just kind of march through the history, you've sort of singled out Sundays in different historical periods and sort of done a vignette, a profile of how the day might have been celebrated by some typical people. So let's take a look at some of those. For instance, medieval Catholic England. How did a typical person, how would you or I have experienced Sunday if we were living then?
Right. I noted that there, I thought, would be four themes. Working, a better meal than usual, church, and a lot of fun. And the working is a little bit surprising because by the Middle Ages, it was pretty clear that Christians were not supposed to work on Sunday. It had taken on the character of a rest day, just like the Jewish Sabbath. But because almost everyone was a farmer or peasant of some kind, there were things that have to be done every day of the week, as farmers today know as well. So during the summer months, at least, Sunday would often include a bit of work. But that would be followed by church. We don't know exactly how many people attended church, but everyone belonged to the church. They were baptized into it and born into it.
What did people do for fun in medieval England?
Well, they played games, not necessarily the same games we would. There was an early form of football already by this time, but there was archery and so forth. But mostly they went to taverns and socialized. I think that was one of the big purposes of Sunday. That was the day when you would especially see a lot of people and you could relax.
Huh. Was there much of a conflict even back then about how people used Sunday? I mean, did some church leaders think that people shouldn't go to the tavern and drink and people should just stay home and worship?
Yeah, the tension began again after about 500 when the church began to give Sunday a series of rules. These are things you should and shouldn't do on Sunday. And so, yes, there was always a sort of tension. But people ended up pretty much doing what they wanted to do, I think.
And what about after the Protestant Reformation? Did Sunday change much then? In general, I think of the Protestants as having had a great deal many more rules.
It did change. In fact, the Catholic Sunday and the Protestant Sunday, if you look at the theory, they weren't that different from each other. The real distinguishing point for me was more the English/Puritan Sunday. Puritans were a minority in the English church, but the sort of Sunday they envisioned wasn't that different from what the majority of English church people envisioned as well. It tended to be stricter than just about everyone else. So the essential dividing line, I do show a Protestant Sunday in the book, but one of the reasons I show it is to illustrate that it wasn't that different from a Catholic Sunday. The real difference was with the English Sunday.
You know the Little House on the Prairie books?
Mm-hmm.
I remember reading one of those, and the description of a Sunday was so different than it is now. And I just remember the children were supposed to sit still, and they were supposed to spend the whole day reading Scripture. And I think somebody got whipped because they went out sledding when they weren't supposed to. When did that kind of Sunday appear?
That's definitely from the English and Puritan tradition. And that was an important tradition in the Americas as well. Of course, a lot of the first settlers came to New England. But settlers who came along the rest of the eastern seaboard generally did not insist on such a strict Sunday as that. So in the Americas, you had both traditions, but that English Puritan tradition was very strong. And typically, the insistence on a strict Sunday comes from that tradition.
Hmm. Now, there's another kind of Sunday, a whole different Sunday tradition that you focus on. Maybe we could fast forward to 19th century France, because that's a very different sort of Sunday, isn't it?
Yes, it is. And it also includes some of the elements that we've seen earlier in history or earlier in the book. That is, there's certainly opportunity for church and so on. But by now, there are a lot of other things going on Sunday as well. Not everyone has to belong to a church anymore. So they also enjoy their day off, which is Sunday. So the Sunday in France, which to me was the most famous Sunday ever, with the famous painting by Seurat and all the cafe scenes and all the depictions of Sunday scenes in novels and short stories. This is the Sunday that everybody held up as the thing to love or as the thing to hate. Now, most people loved it, but again, it was the English Puritan tradition that didn't like the French model. They regarded it as licentious and so on. And if you compare it to an English Sunday, in fact, there was a lot more going on in France.
What kind of Sunday was it? What did people do?
Well, it could include church, but it certainly included opportunities to go to cafes, restaurants. Restaurant was a new invention, a big invention in the late 19th century. It included lots of parks that were available in France, pleasure trains to the ocean, if you lived in Paris, for instance. Walking down the boulevard would often offer entertainment enough because people went out to be seen and to see other people, so the famous promenade of the French Sunday. So there are a lot of park scenes, a lot of cafe scenes, a lot of things going on outdoors.
So Sunday was really a play day.
Well, it was, but you could say that that was true in the Middle Ages as well, that there's always this element of holy day and holiday. Those have come to mean two opposite things in modern English, but in the Middle Ages they meant exactly the same thing. And it's probably not bad to think about that, to think that a holy day usually includes holiday sorts of things, and a holiday might include holy day sorts of things. So in other words, the two terms go together.
So how do you see these two strands playing out today in modern-day America in the Sunday that we've evolved?
Well, you can see the Puritan strain still, and you can see the continental European strain still. The Puritan strain is still alive in certain religious denominations. Certainly, you can see that all the high activity of a Sunday, the sporting events and so forth, that definitely comes from the continental European traditions. And they kind of fuse into something distinctly American. In fact, the tendency to have a lot of sporting activities on Sunday is more American than it is either European or English.
Has writing this book changed anything about the way you approach your Sundays?
Now that I'm an old guy, maybe not. If I had been a kid, I probably would have played more. But as an old guy, I don't mind resting on Sunday anymore. I think it's certainly, if you come from kind of the stricter English tradition, it maybe helps you re-envision Sunday, that there are more possibilities than you imagine, and that the English tradition is just one alternative.
So the subtext of your book could be getting rid of Sunday guilt?
I suppose it could be that. Or just re-envisioning it for yourself, you know, how you want to make it a more creative Sunday.
I have to confess, Sunday is probably my least favorite day of the week. And over the years, I mean, there's a particular kind of dread and sort of feeling in the pit of my stomach, Sunday afternoons especially, you know, the weekend's coming to an end and you really have to start kind of thinking about work again. I used to think that was just me, and over the years I've come to realize that a lot of people have that kind of Sunday dread, and it does kind of color my perception of the whole day. Did you find that that's true of a lot of people?
Well, I didn't go and do interviews or make a systematic study, but that was the impression I got. And that, in fact, one psychologist coined a term called Sunday neurosis. I thought about that, and I thought, well, there could be at least two kinds of Sunday neuroses. The first kind that he meant was the kind that dreads Sunday's coming because it means an end to the routine of the week. And when routine stops, you have to stop and think about things. You might even have to question your routine. You might have to ask the big questions, like, what am I doing? What's the purpose of all this? The routine sometimes distracts you from all the big questions of life. So some people don't like that seizing of the routine. I think the kind that you're talking about is more in the French model, and that is you like Sunday so much that you can't stand to see it go. You're just dreading Monday coming again, and when you have to go out of this kind of timeless existence that might emerge, at least briefly, on Sunday.
Well, you know, I think doctors tell us that most heart attacks happen Monday mornings, so evidently a lot of people feel that way.
Maybe other people feel the same way. But then there are people who can't wait to get back to work. That's why I found that bumper sticker humorous, which said, thank God it's Monday. Because, of course, before it was always, thank God it's Friday. But this time, thank God it's Monday. They're so glad that the lack of routine of Sunday is past.
Craig Harline is the author of Sunday, A History of the First Day, From Babylonia to the Super Bowl. He spoke with Ann Strange Chaps.
Well, it's Sunday and it's pouring down rain. I know that we both kind of feel the same. And where will you be when the cold starts setting in? And where will you be when the little light grows dim? Well, we woke up this morning with clouds over our bed. Explain why our love up and went dead. Well, it's okay if you feel a little bitter pain. 'Cause it's Sunday and it's pouring down rain.
You have favorite weekend rituals? We'd love to hear about them. You can send us email through our website at ttbook.org. It's always nice to hear from you. Coming up, we're off to the movies to watch Jean-Luc Godard's Weekend as we conclude our Hour on the Weekend. I'm Jim Fleming. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from PRI, Public Radio International. David Sterrett is the longtime film critic for the Christian Science Monitor. He's also the author of many books about film, including one called The Films of Jean-Luc Godard, Seeing the Invisible. Does Sterrett remember the first time he saw Godard's classic 1967 film Weekend?
I don't think I do. The reason I say that is because I'm pretty sure that I saw it when it was quite new. And for whatever reason, I don't have a strong memory of it. That would have been in the 1960s, probably around 67 or 68. And, you know, the old cliche, if you remember the 60s, you weren't really there. So that could play a part in all this. But some years later, a lot of years later, maybe about 15 years later, I saw it again and was completely blown away by it. The energy of it, the audacity of it, the kind of helter-skelter strangeness of it really hit me very, very hard. And ever since then, I've regarded it as really one of the great films of its era.
Could you describe the storyline of Weekend?
Oh, more or less. For a really complete description, it would take a really long time. But it starts out very much like a kind of a film noir in color. It has exactly the kind of opening plot moves that we expect in the movies about treachery and betrayal and deceit that are so familiar from American films noir. And what we have is a middle-class couple named Roland and Corinne. They live in an apartment in Paris. And we learn from a couple of conversations in the very beginning of the film, one that Corinne has with a friend and one that Roland has on the phone, that Corinne's father is dying in a distant town, and they're afraid that he might change his will and take Corinne out of the will so that they won't inherit anything. So they have decided to drive to this town, which is called Wainville, and do something about this, even if that means killing the old guy before he has a chance to change his will. We also discover that once that's done, Roland plans to kill Corinne and get all the money for himself. Also, Corinne has developed plans to kill Roland and keep all the money for herself. So at the beginning, we have what really are themes in the film, which are, first of all, the really flamboyant critique of materialism and the idea that people will do anything to get money, to get wealth, to get riches. They then hop into their car, which is a little beat-up French convertible, a fossil, and they start driving, and that's the weekend trip that gives the movie its name. And along the way, they run into all kinds of people. They run into one of the most famous sequences in all of modern film takes place early in the movie once they get started on their trip, when they run into a traffic jam. And the traffic jam scene goes on for something like 10 minutes, and it's filmed in two very, very long traveling shots with Godard's camera traveling along the side of the road as Roland and Corinne inch ahead through this insane jam of cars in their little car.
Take that traffic jam scene, for instance. What's the intended political end of that?
Well, more generally, but probably crystallized most strongly in that particular scene, the automobile is a kind of a symbol for materialism. The automobile embodies, in a sense, everything that ultra-ultra-leftists like Godard were against in the middle to late 1960s and on into the 1970s. The car represents the thing that you sell so much of your labor in order to buy, and then you treasure it, even though it's just an object. And you compete with other people to have a better one or a nicer one than they have, and just go on and on. All of these things are in Godard's mind. So on on one level, the cars in all of these scenes that run all through the movie until near the end has to do with his radical critique of materialism, which he sees as a natural outgrowth of capitalism, which he is very much against. I mean, Godard, by this stage, by the time we get into 1967, 1968, and a little beyond that, had gotten so far left that he regarded the French Communist Party as a bunch of right-wingers. So he's very extreme in his views. And whereas his politics today will seem at best quaint to a lot of people, even wrong-headed, probably to the great majority of people who might see this film today, what's important, I think, still today, is the critique of what's wrong with the kind of way of life that has become so dominant in Western civilization and in most civilization. Are we too materialistic? Do we allow objects and money to clog our lives the same way that all of these cars that can't even move are clogging the road in the traffic jam scene, or are burning and exploding and crashing into each other in so many other scenes? The question is raised, is this really how we want to live? And Godard does something that satirists have been doing for millennia, I guess, which is simply to push the thing to its limits, splash it all over, in this case, the movie screen, and let us draw our own conclusions. But one character says at one point in the movie that the only way you can confront the horror of bourgeois life is with more horror, and that is what Godard gives us in a lot of Weekend.
Looking back on it now, knowing what Godard's politics are, it's interesting how relevant it seems to today. There is a scene also in the movie with the garbage men, who are African and Arab, and this, it's clear that it resonates then, but it also seems as though it's telling us a lot about now.
Oh, absolutely.
Ce n'est pas cela que je cherche. Je prétends que la liberté d'un noir a autant de valeur que celle d'un blanc. Je prétends qu'un noir est en droit pour conquérir sa liberté de faire tout ce que d'autres hommes ont dû faire pour conquérir la leur.
Here we have two disenfranchised, marginalized minority group members who, each one speaking for the other, deliver two long speeches about their grievances and about the kinds of radical, extreme, and even violent actions that they feel are justifiable to them if it will help them get redress of their grievances, which pretty much means overthrowing society as it exists now in the forms that we're familiar with. It's a really interesting scene because it's another time when the movie almost seems to stop in its tracks. In this case, it's for a couple of quite long political speeches.
De plus, nous sommes inférieurs en nombre. Nous avons donc choisi la guérilla comme la solution qui s'imposait.
You describe Weekend as being among Godard's most exciting films. It didn't do very well at the box office, but still you think people should view it as an extraordinary moment in movie making?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if anyone wants to get a sense of the fervor of the political left, which was so visible and so vocal in ways that are unimaginable right now in America and in much of the rest of the world, Weekend would be a really good place to start. I mean, I think it is a tremendously exciting film. It has a tremendous rhythm to it, a tremendous visual rhythm that keeps coming and changing and taking you by surprise. I think its rhythms are sort of Stravinskyan. And because it's in cinema, which is a very conservative art form, a film made in 1967 can have the kind of surprise that Stravinsky had way back in 1913. So on that level, I think it's quite an experience if you leave yourself open to what it's trying to accomplish. But it's also, I think, Godard's angriest film. And I think it's one of the angriest films ever made. Godard at this stage of the game is full of rage. I think he's full of rage at the way his own movies have not been accepted by a public that he sees as benighted and reactionary. And he's enraged by what he sees as the complete moral turpitude of modern capitalistic society. And his anger fills every frame of this movie. Now, that's, you know, people hearing this on the radio are not going to say, hey, that sounds good, let's rent that. you know, I'd like to see one of the angriest movies ever made. But, you know, it's like other kinds of works of art in any medium that you name, that, you know, you might not want to have this particular painting hanging over the fireplace, but every once in a while you look at the horrific things it depicts and you are deeply stirred. You might not want to read this particular novel to your kids at bedtime, but every once in a while you dip into it and you remember how this dark, angry vision touches something deep inside you. And Weekend is like that. It's not to go to see on a Saturday night or to have your friends over and drink some wine and watch Weekend and, you know, pause it a few times to get more popcorn. But it's a movie to watch if you really want to immerse yourself in a particular kind of socio-cultural, political attitude that was very visible and very vocal in the 1960s, which is almost absent today, and which I think we really need to learn about and keep fresh in our minds, because we can still learn things from all of this. And all of this filtered through the sensibility of an incredibly inventive screen artist who is determined to realize his vision without thinking twice about whether or not he's going to make any money out of this. In that sense, it's a very angry enterprise, but it's also a very exciting enterprise and a very pure enterprise in its own scruffy, disreputable kind of way.
Film critic David Sterrett is the author of the films of Jean-Luc Godard, Seeing the Invisible. He also does the commentary track for the DVD release of Weekend.
Thursday's the worst day, Friday's great, cause I can hardly wait until the weekend. I should be clocking in at 8, but I'm a little late. Can't pay my baby cause I'm never on a date. 2 till 10, and then it's Friday again. Here come the weekend. Here come the weekend. Here come the weekend. The working week's so tough, I think I've had enough until the weekend. I've had an overdose, the doctor's knows, but it just don't ease the pain. Going on the sick, don't do the trick. Sooner or later I'll be clocking in again. Working like a dog or a check-a-day. Never see enough of my take-home pay. They pay me for the shift, my favorite's given a gift. Here come the weekend.
It's To the Best of Our Knowledge. I'm Jim Fleming. If you'd like a copy of this hour, you can call the radio store at 1-800-747-7444 and ask for program number 610B, Weekend. If you have questions or comments about the program, you can send us email through our website at ttbook.org. It's always nice to hear from you. To the Best of Our Knowledge is produced at Wisconsin Public Radio. This program was produced by Doug Gordon, with help from Mary Lou Finnegan, Ann Strain Champs, Charles Monroe Kane, and Veronica Rickard. Our executive producer is Steve Paulson. Our technical director is Kirill Owen.
PRI, Public Radio International.